I'm Joy Manning, editor of Edible Philly.
And I'm Marisa McClellan, author of Food in Jars.
Welcome to Local Mouthful. We're here to talk about living the food life in Philadelphia and beyond. This week, we're going to talk about homemade pizza, packing lunches for school or work, and pickles with our guest, PJ Hopkins of Bryan Street Picklery. But first, let's compare notes on an article that we read this week.
The New York Times published a piece entitled My Dinner with Longevity Expert Dan Buettner, and in parentheses it said, no kale required. This was an article about one New York Times writer's dinner and just discovering what are foods that will make you live a long time. Apparently, Dan Buettner's book called The Blue Zone Solution is about five areas of the world where people sort of forget to die. And so
he has several of these Blue Zone books where he looks at the habits. I mean, not just dietary, but many habits that help people live long and not just long, but healthy and active lives. And this one, I think, really focuses specifically in on the food.
Yes. So what do you think, Joy? If you eat certain things, will you live forever?
I definitely believe that a person's diet has a big role in not just how long they're likely to live and the prevention of chronic lifestyle diseases, but their quality of life.
Yeah.
I know I feel better when I eat certain things and I feel worse when I eat certain things.
No, I totally agree with that. One of the things that he recommends or that the data shows from these different zones is that they eat a lot of vegetables and grains and beans, really no cow dairy and very little meat. And I do wonder if there's any sort of thought taken into account of, you know, they talk about different blood types needing different nutrition and sort of where your ancestry is from, your body, your sort of physiology has been, I don't know, over time you've evolved to thrive on certain foods better than others. Like I know that me personally, I have tried to be a vegetarian many times and I have a really hard time. My body seems to need just a little bit of animal protein to function better.
I think that the intersection of food and lifestyle is super complicated. And the studies that he talks about are largely observational studies. Yeah. Where you look at a population, you ask them what they do, and you draw conclusions. That's not the same as a controlled experiment that might give us more detailed, reliable data on specific foods. So, I mean, he talks a lot about Sardinia in this particular article, and the culture of community there, the lack of stress that we experience. Do these things impact longevity even more than food?
Possibly.
I might guess that they do.
I think that the last sentence of the article is probably the most telling when they talk, someone asks him, you know, do they eat kale salad in these cultures? And his response is really, no, they eat what they enjoy. And I thought it was interesting that it wasn't so much about aggressively healthy foods or what we think of as aggressively healthy, so much as enjoyment and pleasure and community.
Right. That definitely plays a role in the, in the blue zones. And I certainly think most people can afford and would benefit from eating less meat, less processed foods, more vegetables. But we are a long way from having it figured, as much as it might sell books, we're a long way from having it figured out what we're supposed to eat so that we forget to die, frankly.
And you know what? Maybe it's okay to embrace our mortality.
Well, that's a heavy topic. What's up next? What's our next? Moving on.
Well, from there we go. From mortality, we're heading right into homemade pizza.
Oh, pizza.
We've talked about pizza a lot on this podcast in its short lifespan, but I feel like it is an endlessly juicy topic. And today we want to talk about it from the spin of, you know, homemade pizza being actually an easy convenience food that you can make at home without a lot of, you know, craziness. It doesn't have to be this big event. And so, Joy, I know that you are really good at making homemade pizza as sort of a weeknight staple.
I have a system. Actually, first let me say I recently introduced this rule with pizza where we can only have it one time a month because I'm trying this lower carb approach for my health. But it was unthinkable that we would just rule out pizza because, I mean, in our wedding vows, Dan promised that he would always make me pizza. I do a lot behind the scenes to make sure that the pizza comes together, but it's Dan that puts the pizzas together on the peel and puts them in the oven. But some of the things that I do to make it easy are I always make two doughs. I never make one, and I will always put that second dough in the freezer to be quickly defrosted.
That's smart.
Later. I also cut up my 3-ounce blocks of mozzarella, freeze those, which it's not a best practice to freeze your cheese, but then I always know it's there. I have a cup of tomatoes, pureed tomatoes, ready to go in the freezer. So it's really just a matter of taking that stuff out and defrosting it. And then I proceed with the toppings that I have in my fridge, like vegetables and, you know, some pepperoni or something.
Yeah, I think that's what, you know, using what you have in your fridge is one of the things that can make homemade pizza a convenience food. Because if you have the crust and some sauce to put on it, and I always have some pesto, homemade pesto in my freezer, which is another really great topper for pizza. Any kind of cheese that you have works. Mozzarella is ideal. When I sneak in alternative cheeses, maybe a little cheddar, my husband gives me the side eye and is like, this is not pizza.
Oh, I should say we always use a blend of mozzarella and cheddar.
Do you?
Yeah. I feel like mozzarella has that melty, stringy pizza. Gotta have it for a pizza quality, but yeah. Cheddar really lends it some sharp flavor, I think.
Yeah, I like a little cheddar. I also, you know, growing up in my hippie household that I did, you know, pizza had broccoli on it. Pizza had kale on it. It was sort of what, and it was very whole wheaty. And so when I make pizza, I do a combination of whole wheat and regular flour so that it doesn't turn into cardboard.
I was doing that for a long time. In fact, most of the past 10 years I've done that. But recently, I think around the time I decided that I was going to have pizza at home only one time a month,
yeah,
I was like, forget it. I'm just making the white crust. You know, I'm not convinced that wheat flour is so much better for you. And you know, if I'm only going to have it one time a month, I really want it to be as delicious as it can be. So I'm back on the white flour for pizza train.
I like it.
I do try to always serve it with a salad, though, to sort of make it not so bready and cheesy, you know, so the meal is sort of half vegetables, half pizza.
No, I think that's smart.
Do you serve salad with your pizza or something else?
I always do. However, selling the salad to my other pizza eating companions is often something of a challenge, but I always eat a lot of the salad. But I also, you know, I am, you know, the more vegetables, the better, whether it's on my pizza or on the side. So, you know, I'm a little weird that way. Now, do you do a long ferment with your dough? Do you let it rise for a long time?
I'm very haphazard about it. Usually the first day, you know, because I'm making two doughs, it doesn't ferment at all, really. We just make it rises. Then we'll make the pizza, but the other dough goes into the freezer, and then sometimes it will sit in our refrigerator for 2-3 days before we get around to making it. So that dough usually has some aging on it, some additional fermentation.
Yeah.
I know I should be more conscientious about that. When we had Joe Badia on in episode 1, he certainly recommended that, but I haven't really implemented that strategy yet.
And now, Joy, I know that you have you store your pizza dough recipe in a secret place. Will you tell us where it is?
Oh, I do. I have it. Well, first of all, when it comes to any type of a baking project, I vastly prefer measuring stuff. It's just easier. There's only one bowl that gets dirty.
You mean weighing things?
Weighing. I weigh things. I have a scale. Sorry about that. But because of that, I have just the grams of each ingredient written on a post-it note on the top of my stand mixer. So then it's always handy.
That is so smart.
When I need it. I've Instagrammed this if you want to steal my recipe, although it does harken back to the days of part whole wheat, part bread flour. So. Yeah.
Well, and just one more shout out for homemade pizza. There is a really great free class on Craftsy that I took last year, taught by Peter Reinhart.
The bread guy.
The bread guy. And it was awesome. It really helped me elevate my homemade pizza game. So if you feel like you are in the wilds of homemade pizza and don't know where to start, it's a really good, really good class to figure out how to get going.
I'll have to check that out.
It's really useful. All right.
So now it's getting to be that time of year where those of us who have school-age kids are getting ready to send them back off to school. And with that comes the responsibility of packing their lunches.
It's true.
You would think that as someone without kids that I know nothing about this, but because I have a husband who does not pack his own lunch, I'm actually really familiar with packing lunch for a helpless person because that's Dan. If I don't pack him lunch, he typically doesn't eat.
Well, but to be fair, Dan works in sort of a food desert, right?
He does. He works.
There's not a lot around where he is, so it's hard for him to get lunch.
That's true. Dan is, you know, right with you and me when it comes to having read all the Michael Pollan books. He's not going to go to Wendy's or, you know, so he really does have to bring it or just go hungry. And often I like to make him a huge salad at the beginning of the week based on lentils and vegetables, maybe a grain, maybe brown rice. And then he can eat that throughout the week and easily dress it up with like leftover chicken or some crumbled cheese. Mm-hmm. Not that I do that every week for him, but that's one way I try to keep his lunchbox full.
You are a good person. I also pack lunches sometimes for my husband. Because I work at home, I don't have to pack my own lunch. When I worked in an office, I certainly packed lunches almost every day because either I was on a serious budget and so couldn't afford to eat out every day, or I was trying to eat more healthfully. And so for me, when I used to pack lunches, I was a big fan of making a pot of soup at the beginning of the week. And then because I love jars, I would portion it out into wide mouth pint jars, and I kept a bowl at my desk, so I would pour out my soup into my bowl and microwave it at work every day. But my lunch packing for my husband now is a little bit more haphazard. It's basically only if we have leftovers, because he works at the University of Pennsylvania, and so there are a lot of options that are around there. But if you have kids and you're packing lunches, you know, it can be really hard, particularly because there are a lot of limitations on what kids can bring to school these days.
Allergies
are a big deal. I know that a lot of people are using like soy butter or sunflower seed butter in place of peanut butter, because with all of the peanut allergies that are out there, peanut butter is a no-go at most schools these days, which is a bummer because it was a staple of our childhood. Did you eat a lot of peanut butter as a kid? No, you didn't like it.
No, I did like it. My mom did not have the usual, I shouldn't say usual, but my mom was not into packing lunches. She often would send me to school with one slice of leftover pizza wrapped in a plastic wrap in a brown paper bag. Or even sadder, one package of those orange crackers. I guess they had peanut butter in them. Do you know the ones I'm talking about?
I do.
I'd open my brown paper bag at school and there would be one pack of those orange crackers in it. My mom has never been a lunch eater, so I think she just doesn't get it. But I didn't have a lot of peanut butter sandwiches at school. I mean, unless I made them.
My mom took her job as lunch packer very seriously during my childhood. And because we were a very healthy eating household, there was a lot of like super grainy whole wheat bread. I remember a phase too where I said, I'm not eating sandwiches anymore. I was done with sandwiches. And so she would pack me little containers of granola and yogurt and cut up fruit. And I would make my own little like yogurt parfait at lunchtime. My sister always had really sensitive teeth. And so my mother would peel her apples for her and then put them in a bag with lemon and a twist tie.
Wow.
She took it really seriously. And to this day, my mother packs a lunch for my dad to take to work every day. And they have a very like, he gets a sandwich, but he only has one piece of bread and there's like six pieces of lettuce on top. So it's practically a salad in a sandwich. It includes pickles, which she blots on a paper towel before she incorporates. It is a sandwich to end all sandwiches.
That's amazing.
Yeah. But these days...
I always knew you and me and your mom would get along.
I'm sure you would.
Someday we'll meet Mama McClellan.
She'll be here in September. But I do have some other lunch tips, which is that when you're in doubt, if your kid doesn't want to eat a sandwich, one of the secret salvations is the roll-up. And when I say roll-up, I simply mean like either a tortilla or even a rice paper wrapper or a piece of lettuce. You know, instead of making a sandwich, you can roll things up. So maybe some lunch meat or some cheese, or even if you're, you know, my favorite spread that you can only get in Oregon in my home state is a thing called tofu pate, which is like the best egg salad analog I've ever found.
I've never heard of that.
They only distribute it on the West Coast, but you can really do a lot with rolling up of things. Any other secret tips, Joy?
Well, I don't really love having sandwiches in my lunch. I like what you describe with the parfait. Sometimes I like to have vegetable sticks and a dip, hummus and cucumber slices. I love cheese and nuts. Yeah. I like to have like a little lunch buffet in small containers for myself. Sometimes I'll make some flaxseed crackers, which I mean, that's pretty hippie-ish, right? but I find even when I'm in a place where I have tons of options, I'd rather have my own healthy lunch because I don't enjoy lunch that much just if I'm working. You know, over the years, my job has taken me to New York a lot. Mm-hmm. And even on days when I've worked in New York, I just bring my lunch from home. There's so many good options, but I don't want to be rushing away from my desk to grab lunch. I'd rather like use those splurge times on more relaxed, enjoyable meals. Yeah. So I've been known to bring my lunch out of state.
Well, if you have any lunch packing tips, we want to hear them. If you leave them in the comments on the show notes page for this episode, or you can tweet us or Instagram us or Facebook us.
We would love for you to Instagram your lunch to us. I would feel less lonely. I Instagram my lunch almost every day.
I Instagrammed my lunch just today. All right. Now we are going to talk with our guest. So PJ Hopkins is one of the co-owners and co-founders of Philadelphia's newest pickle company called Bryant Street Picklery. Welcome, PJ.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming here. So tell us a little bit about how you got interested in pickling.
Well, you see the Zing Beans here. That is basically the main product that it all started with. My girlfriend, Valentina, and also my business partner, she and I were down in New Orleans for Jazz Fest about, I guess, 5 years ago now. And right outside of the Jazz Fest, there's this bar called Liuza's, right outside of the horse track, if you've ever been down to Jazz Fest. And it's like 9 o'clock at night. Everyone gets out of the festival. It's super hot. Party in the street going on, brass band, horns, the whole nine, and everyone's in the street drinking these Bloody Marys with these dilly beans.
Yeah.
And I'm from around here, from the Northeast, so I had never seen that. I'm always like, I was familiar with the, you know, celery in the Bloody Mary, that sort of thing. And we got to the point where we're just ordering the Bloody Marys just to eat these beans. And I asked the guy at the counter, I'm like, what do you put in them? And he told me, like, there's basically four simple ingredients. I came home, started messing around with it.
Yeah.
Kind of tweaked my own recipe. And then as, I mean, from looking around here, I think you are victim of the same disease where you just realize that, you know, you can essentially pickle anything, not to quote Portlandia, as people probably do to you all the time. But that's kind of how it started for me. And I started messing around with different things. And here we are.
Cool. So I know that that Bryant Street Picklery is a team effort. Can you tell us a little bit about how you guys got started and your team?
Yeah, I mean, it all started out as kind of like a joke where it was me and my buddy Bill, who lives up in New York. We're sitting at a bar, and he was a big fan of the pickles always. He has friends in the food business.
Okay.
Like Hank's Sauce, if you ever heard of them, the hot sauce company. They're based down in Sea Isle. Like the Hot Diggity guys. He went to high school with those guys. So he was super into it and like kind of gave us some connections, and we just kind of spitballed like silly names, and we came up with Bryant Street, and we were like, okay, well, all we need is a logo and to start getting it out there a little bit.
Yeah.
And then we started asking around, and my other partner, Kristen, she does all the, you know, social media design, all the sort of artwork stuff. One of her partners did all our design work, and then she knew someone that knew how to do the website, and one thing led to another, and all of a sudden we had most of what you need to sort of get something rolling. Yeah. And then my other partner, Eli, he helps me with all the production and sort of like the business development type stuff.
Now, I know Philadelphia can be a tough town to start a food business in. Have you had much trouble with the health department?
Initially, yes.
Uh-huh.
Not so much trouble as I would say we were just confused.
Uh-huh.
We kind of started this. We're still less than a year old. We started about back in October, November is when we really made our first batch in November. And come May came around and we wanted to, like, you know, jump into the farmer's market street fair scene. And we're like, okay, can go online and figure it out. Not the case. I was, you know, we all work 9 to 5. So I was basically going to L&I and the health, taking a cab out to West Philly to the health department and like sitting in all these places. And finally, after about a month and a half, we got all the permitting we needed. And for what we sell at the markets and whatnot, we don't really have to deal with a whole lot of the health department stuff.
That's good.
Since it's pre-processed.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, I expect that if this continues to grow and we have to deal with a sort of more permanent location, then the frustration will continue to build. But
yeah,
but for right now, we're kind of past that hurdle. Yeah.
So how many days a month do you produce? Are you guys producing a lot, or?
Yeah, this is like peak season for us. Okay. So we try to use like as much local stuff as possible. So when we started back in November, it was like I had all these beans that I made and we were kind of giving the beans out. And then beets came into season, mm-hmm. beets and carrots. So we did in like February, we did a bunch of beets. We did carrots in March. But yeah, we try to do it like 4 to 5 times a month.
Okay.
So we work out of Greens Grow Kitchen in Fishtown.
Mm-hmm.
And we, you know, pay hourly. We do the graveyard shift. We go in there. I'm going in tonight, actually.
How's it feeling? How's it going to manage both as a growing business and a full-time job? You said you all have full-time jobs as well.
Yeah. I mean, initially it was tough.
Yeah.
But now we're getting to the point where we're learning a bit more about, you know, the relationship between producers and retailers. That mm-hmm. was kind of an initial hurdle for us. But we've met some super cool people through these like various sort of like marketing events, and you know, Fair Food runs some really awesome events. We work with Common Market and they've hooked mm-hmm. us up with some people. And we attended this like Sam Adams like small business event, if you've ever attended that. This is back in maybe like May when okay. we had nothing and people were just like, call this guy. And
yeah.
it's amazing in the food business, or at least like in my sector of the food business, how friendly and like willing to help people are. Like we do so many collaborations already. Like we have 4 collaborations going on right now. And like for me coming from the business world, like I work in insurance and it's like, it's so cutthroat. And then you come here and I was like, yeah, man, like let's hang out. Like, sure. And I just did not expect that. And it's very kind of, you know, refreshing.
That's great. What's the feedback been like from your customers?
People seem pretty into it.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, this is proof, I guess. Like, I never would have thought that I would be doing something like this, talking about it, which is cool that you guys are into it. But yeah, the hoagie relish is definitely, I think, the primary driver, uh-huh. which unfortunately is like the hardest thing to make, most time consuming.
Well, tell us a little bit about how do you make the hoagie relish? What's in it?
We call it the hellish hoagie relish. And it's red cherry pepper is the primary uh-huh. like spice, the heat. And then we do red bell pepper, green bell pepper, onions and garlic.
Mm-hmm.
And then we don't use any like preservatives or any chemicals in any of our products. We're still working on tinkering with like a natural preservative. So we're working with like some grape leaves and some, you know, oak leaves. And I'm still kind of on the fence as to how effective that stuff is. I'm sure we could talk off the air about that. But for the hoagie relish, we roast half of it.
Uh-huh.
So it kind of gives it that sort of like more flavor than, you know, the yeah. regular jar that you would see in the supermarket now. And then we cook it up like a relish.
Yeah. Is it a sweet relish or just totally vinegary?
There is sugar yeah. in it, but I mean the heat that you get the sweetness,
uh-huh.
But the heat definitely overpowers. I mean, we market it to people as like, if you like spicy, this is for you.
Sounds great.
And we actually just started a collaboration yesterday with these guys that run a bagel truck called Schmear It, if you've ever seen them cool. around. And what they do is they make like, they take cream cheese and then you can kind of build your own spread. So yeah. they're using our spread now. And they use like mango and scallion, like with the spice in the cream cheese. It's pretty nice.
That sounds
I think it'll do well. So.
Cool. Well, where can people find your pickles?
Right now we are at several farmers markets. We're at Common Ground Market at Broad and Mount Vernon. That's one of the food trust's mm-hmm. newer markets every Sunday. And we're at the Nerd Street, North 3rd Street Market every Wednesday in Old City. We also do the Upper Marion Farmers Market in King of Prussia. We do the Manioc Farmers Market. And then we bounce around. We'll be at Night Market at the Mucho Bueno truck. That's our buddy who runs like this taco truck. And he lets us. It's kind of cool, actually. We just sit there.
Awesome. Him.
Yeah.
All right, cool.
Hope to be in retailers soon. So
that's exciting. Well, thank you so much for coming in today to talk to us about your new pickle company.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Now it's time for Joy to tell us what she has found at the market this week.
My choice for what I found at the market this week is actually something I found on the internet. I'm working on closing the fall issue of Edible Philly. That will be out or when you hear this, it will already be out, and you'll be able to see we have a little piece on the hoagie relish, actually,
that we
just talked about. And we also are publishing an excerpt from Barry Estabrook's Pigtails book, which is all about industrial pig farming and how upsetting it is.
Yeah. He's amazing.
An amazing book, yeah. An amazing writer. I hope that you'll read it in Edible Philly and you'll do exactly what I did, which I put together a list of resources for people who would read the article and maybe want to source better, more ethical local pork for mm-hmm. themselves right away.
Yeah.
And before I was even done pulling this resource guide together, I had ordered a pig share, a quarter pig.
Oh my gosh.
It's actually from Philadelphia Cow Share. So now they do cow and pig shares. And all the pork that you get through them is pastured,
uh-huh.
which means it, you know, eats grass and yeah. roams around. And it's a heritage breed. And what most surprised me about this is the price point. I buy the best pork I can get at something like Whole Foods or Reading Terminal Market, and it's not cheap at all.
Yeah.
But, and I mean, this pork isn't cheap, but it's roughly $10 a pound, which is good. And I'm getting all kinds yeah. of great cuts. And so I'm getting 32 pounds of it for $330.
Wow.
And, I mean, that's a lot of pork. I, as we have mentioned before, have the chest freezer, but if you don't, it supposedly fits in about half of a normal above your fridge freezer.
Wow. Okay.
Or, I mean, it is something that you could easily split with a friend.
Yeah.
And I haven't tasted this pork, but if it's anything like their beef, I'm sure it's going to have superior flavor. But best of all is I get the feeling of, you know, being off any type of factory farm pork now for the next, I mean, they guess this pork will last me about 4 months. So.
Well, and you guys don't eat a ton of meat.
That's true. It could last longer.
But do you have any idea what kind of cuts you're going to get?
Yeah, there's chops and ribs and cutlets and ground pork and shanks for soup and bacon.
That's exciting.
So I can't wait to get it. It's coming in a few weeks, and I think it's going to be a wonderful, ethical, delicious treat.
That'll be nice. And, you know, those chest freezers make that kind of thing really easy. Yeah. I would have a hard time. My freezer is always full to bursting as it is because I'm always squirreling away like fruit for different jams later in the year.
You could share with a friend, though, maybe.
Yeah.
A different friend without a chest freezer.
I have to confess, though, as someone who grew up in a half-Jewish household with a mother who didn't eat pork, I might have a hard time committing to that much pork product.
I really prefer pork to beef.
Do you?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I like it, but it pork has been sort of a food language that I've had to learn as an adult because we literally did not eat it in my household, which is funny because my mother was the most secular, non-observant Jew in the world. But for some reason, no pork.
I mean, we ate no pork either. We were Catholic, but my mother was a vegetarian, or, yeah. you know, so we just didn't eat any meat at all. Yeah. But as a grown-up food lover, I've really taken to pork, as I guess many others before me have. And I cannot wait to get my hands on all that local bacon at
that
my disposal. And the things that I'll make with it, I mean, who knows? There's going to be a pork shoulder in there. I'll definitely make that, as yeah. we have discussed in previous episodes. I can't wait to try to do the ribs in my pressure cooker.
Oh, yeah. That'll be fun.
And then, of course, a million different types of meatballs and ground meat stir fries. Maybe I'll update everybody on what
yeah.
I should keep a little log of how I make it.
You totally should. I think we should have sort of a quarterly feature, what's Joy doing with her
pork
share.
Yeah, that would be fun.
That would be fun. All
I'll
right.
I'll do that.
Cool.
Well, I think that's it for this week's installment of Local Mouthful. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Yeah.
We hope you follow us on Twitter at Local Mouthful and sign up for our newsletter and catch up on all the episodes that you've missed and our show notes at localmouthful.com. Until next time, happy eating.